Last month, the Central Standard crew got together with a couple dozen listeners for a live storytelling event at Pilgrim Chapel. And for today's broadcast, we're going to take you to hear that show. All the stories are immigration stories, and all the storytellers are local. Let's start at the beginning. What could be more all-American than a hamburger and fries at a drive-thru? And what could be a more Kansas City burger than Winstead's? Well, funny thing about your steak burger, the story behind it comes from Lebanon in 1958. The country was being torn apart by a civil war between Christians and Muslims.
Well, it was a very interesting time.
That's Nabil Haddad.
Hi.
Nabil was just 19 when his father arranged for him to flee the country. He had a safe place to stay with his aunt in Baghdad. It was supposed to be safe. He'd only been in Baghdad for a week when a coup d'etat sent Iraq into turmoil as well.
And they killed King Faisal and the entire royal family, so nobody would have a claim on the kingdom. And there were curfews. There was a lot of killing, dragging colonels and generals in the streets, naked. It was atrocious.
But Nabil did manage to start his own magazine stand. It was near the embassies, which provided a lot of customers, and so it did pretty well. And one day, an American customer gave him a little pointer.
He came to me and he said, listen, in America, not mind you, this is 1959. In America, we sell hamburgers. I didn't know what hamburger was.
He convinced Nabil to open a hamburger joint too.
At that time, we didn't have ketchup. We only had mustard and onions and buns. And so it was so popular. We were at a very good bus station and people would line up the street. And I finally had to send my cousin and say, go count 24 because that's all we can serve anymore. And I got done from 6 o'clock to about 7:30, and we were out of hamburgers every night. By the time, you know, I was 19 years old, I became a tycoon.
Then one day, out of nowhere, he was arrested. They hauled him into an interrogation room, and a captain sat him down, looked him in the eye, and informed him that he was a spy for the Americans, British, and French.
I was shocked again. I said, you gotta be out of your mind. You're crazy. He said, you're not only a spy, you're a rude spy.
A high-ranking person in the Iraqi military vouched for him and miraculously got him out of jail. Not long after that, one of the customers from his magazine stand, Sue was her name, offered to send him to college in the United States. She worked at the American Embassy and pulled some strings. He didn't find out why until years later, when the two of them were reminiscing over a beer at her house in Salina, Kansas.
First thing I said, how dumb the Iraqis were arresting me for being a spy for you. She said, no, they weren't dumb. I said, what do you mean? She said, I headed the CIA in Baghdad. When they arrested you, we realized they uncovered who we were.
So in case you didn't catch that, she was the head of the CIA in Baghdad. She used to buy books from his magazine stand. Then she'd sell them back, and he'd sell them again, making money hand over fist over one book at a time. Like, he'd get to sell it multiple times. So who would question that, right? What she was doing was passing notes.
Every book had notes, whatever. And she said, then Leo Coates, the British guy, comes in there and said, do you have any charts or records? I was passing stuff like an idiot, not knowing what is going on.
So he mentions cha-cha there. What that is it turns out there are these little booklets that would teach you how to dance the cha-cha. And he had a customer who worked for another embassy who was coming in and saying that he had a daughter who wanted to dance the cha-cha. And so that was why he was carrying all these cha-cha instruction manuals. It's just the weirdest thing that this sort of, that international intelligence was being passed under the guise of learning the cha-cha. Amazing. But, so he didn't know that he was a spy, but he was a spy, I guess. And There are some things he didn't know that was problematic for him, but he did know how to make a burger, and that turned out to be very useful in the United States. It got him his first job at McDonald's, where he worked his way up to being a manager at a location in Kansas City, Kansas. And now he runs not just Winstead's, but other restaurants in Kansas City under a business called the Haddad Group. So yeah, we all got here somehow. And even the things we think of as all-American had to get here somehow. Things that are so quintessentially Kansas City, a lot of those things came along for the ride. So these are immigration stories, and this is how we got here. Welcome. I'd like to introduce Ilya Papanako, who came here from the Soviet Union in 1979, meaning he grew up in the height of the Cold War, with his formative years split between Moscow and Overland Park. In other words, on two different sides of a massive propaganda machine. Hi, Ilya.
Hi, Gina. Nice to be here.
So your family was able to come to the U.S. because of two political acts, an act of Congress here in the United States that gave Soviet Jews automatic refugee status, and a move by Brezhnev to let people who had homelands outside of the USSR repatriate?
Yep, that's pretty much the story. The Soviet government in the 70s had decided that they did not want to go the path of Stalin, repress everybody, or eliminate them and ship them out to Siberia. And so they allowed people like the Volga Germans to leave and go to Germany. And people like hardcore zealot Baptists, who were a very unwelcome group in the Soviet Union, to leave for America. And amongst other things, they decided that maybe letting the Jews go to Israel is not really that bad of an idea, specifically because it also created a ability to have a calm and unified Soviet Union. Because a lot of Jews who wanted to leave and go to Israel were very loudly dissenting. There was a famous case where they tried to hijack an airplane, there were demonstrations in front of the Israeli embassy demanding to leave, etc. And so I guess it seemed prudent to just go, well, actually, if they want to go so bad, why don't we let them?
And that was a description of your family. You come from at least a partially Jewish family.
Yes, I come from a mixed family. My dad's Russian, my mom is ethnic Jewish. And so using that as a theoretical excuse, my parents applied for emigration to ostensibly Israel. And that was in 79, early in 79. And by the time that June rolled around, they were told that they could go.
I grew up here in the 80s, and I went to a synagogue here in the 80s, and I remember how people talked about the plight of Jews in the Soviet Union, and I cannot begin to tell you how shocking and hard for me it is to, like, process that the Kremlin was like, okay, sure, go. Because my understanding was just that people were really suffering and having a very hard time getting out.
Well, it wasn't a cakewalk. You really had to jump through a lot of hoops to even apply to get out. And there wasn't much logic as to who was allowed to leave and who wasn't, because some people wound up waiting years to get permission to go. But I guess in my family's case, it was just one of those things. They said, okay, go.
So you went, but first, how did you imagine life in America growing up in Russia during the Cold War?
Well, that's an interesting one. I grew up as part of what they called the cynical generation.
So that's a cynical generation?
Uh-huh. And where that comes from is the fact that my parents' generation, in their youth, truly and genuinely believed in the cult of personality of Stalin. He could do no wrong, and the Soviet Union was headed to glorious communism, and things were shining and bright. And then Nikita Khrushchev came around and revealed that Stalin had actually been a repressive jerk who was responsible for the death of millions of his own people, and that the shining facade was kind of a lie. And so once my parents' generation realized that their belief in the system was shaken, and so their kids grew up knowing that, nah, that's a false front. So growing up, we as kids just knew that whatever the government was telling you, you should probably believe the opposite. If they're saying there's a marvelous harvest, there's probably an awful one. And if they're saying things are great, well, they're probably not good at all. And if they say America is awful and decadent and corrupt, that means America is awesome.
Did you have exposure to anything that would give you like a taste of just anything concrete to associate with America?
Well, yes, we did, but you have to consider two things here. One is the fact that American media at the time, of course, print and movies, and like very limited music, it was all very carefully channeled by the Soviet Union to either reflect negatively on America or just be meaningless crap. So we loved both the meaningless crap and the what we understood to be the opposite of the critiques. So if they said, you know, in America, there's Playboy magazine with nude ladies and it's decadent and corrupt, everybody was like, oh man, I want to see that. And like, as a kid, one of the regular things we did is we'd go to a Saturday matinee. And at one time in 1965, they had an international film festival in Russia. And one of the films that got there from America was a movie called The Great Race that won top prize at the International Film Festival. It was like a crazy comedy starring Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, and Natalie Wood. And as kids, we just loved that comedy because it was completely zany and slapsticky, and it's like a race around the world with and pie throwing and stuff like that. Must have seen it about 7 times. So knew it by heart. So when I get here to the US, I see that it's on TV, and I start watching it, and all of a sudden, there's a scene I've never seen. Because in their race around the world, all of a sudden, these guys stop in Russia. And, oh my God, like, and it's, you know, the typical, of course, portrayal of Russia you'd expect. It's really dark and grim, and there's people with fur hats. And, like the good guy of the movie stands up in his racing vehicle and goes, I'm the great Leslie, and there's absolute silence. And the bad guy stands up and goes, I'm so-and-so, and there's absolute silence. And all of a sudden, Natalie Wood goes, hold on, you guys. Let me show you how it's done. She stands up and goes, Привет, товарищи, which means hello, comrades, in totally accented Russian. And my jaw drops. They cut this part out of the movie when they were showing it in Russia. Mainly because Natalie Wood was actually a daughter of Russian immigrants and spoke fluent Russian throughout her life as a movie star. And I guess they just didn't want people to know that like there were Russian immigrants at all, or much less that they were movie stars. And once again, you know, but that's kind of a surprising bit of what I thought I perfectly well knew being not quite so. The other thing is you have to understand that a lot of stuff is culturally relevant and understandable only once you've been immersed in the culture. Because when I was 12, right before leaving, I read Catcher in the Rye for the first time. And, you know, was really struck by this great book, super relatable. And, I mean, let's forego the fact that in the Soviet Union, nobody had any idea what a catcher was. The translator didn't want to go into a page-long explanation of baseball. So the book was just called Above a Precipice in the Rye. but in any case, you know, what do I know? I haven't read the original. And so I'm reading this book about this poor kid because, see, in Russia, all schools were public. And some really unlucky kids whose parents just didn't want to take the time with them or like who worked too much would send them away to boarding schools where, God, this, how sad, you know? You don't get to see your parents at all. You're at a boarding school. Just awful. And, like, you know, then I'm sure you've all read the book. He runs away and he like goes to visit his parents' apartment, or sees his little sister, and they live in a high-rise building. Well, naturally, I mean, everybody in cities lives in high-rise buildings. And I'm just like, yeah, poor kid, you know, same kind of schmo as I am. Parents like white-collar, typical city dwellers. Well, I get here and reread the book, and for one thing, I like know what a catcher is, and for the second I realized that they actually live in like one of the most fashionable, expensive parts of New York, and he has been sent to 4 different boarding schools, which is super expensive. Jesus, this kid isn't relatable at all. He's a spoiled rich brat.
When we've talked, and even just now, like it strikes me that it's like you were on two opposite sides of a funhouse mirror in a kind of a way.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that I think was one of the most striking parts about getting here and realizing how much of, well, not just the culture that I was experiencing, but the political propaganda that I'd been raised with, you know, because, well, for one thing, of course, you distrust what the government says, so that didn't really change a whole lot when I got here. In fact, I saw it, emphasized more. Because the thing is, this was the 1979, and nuclear war was a definite background theme to a whole lot of stuff going on, you know, somebody pushing the button, and then next thing you know, there's nuclear explosions on the horizon. So, in my school in Russia, it was one giant building that housed all grades 1 through 10. And beneath it was a huge bomb shelter. And once a semester, we'd practice quietly and orderly, going down to the big bomb shelter, all of the grades, and we had our assigned benches where we were supposed to wait out the imminent and unprovoked attack by capitalists. And so then I came here, and in junior high, we would do a tornado drill. Well, you know, it's not really about a tornado. It's at that point, they'd stopped actively calling it a nuclear holocaust drill the way they did during the 50s and 60s, but it was the same thing. And here, there was this absolute conviction that it was those wily communists that were going to attack first and for no good reason. So, you know, really odd to realize that.
Yeah. You know, when you arrived, you said you were about 12?
Yeah, I turned 13 on the way over.
And kids that age, it seems like fitting in is a really big deal. Is that something that you attempted as you were crossing this funhouse mirror?
Oh, I so wanted to be just like everyone else. Well, in junior high, that's all you want to be, is like everyone else. But when you're a fresh off the boat immigrant, that is so not an option. I had to give myself a quick crash course in how to be American. Got a lot of stuff wrong. I don't know, but I still remember trying to teach myself to play basketball, and I was just horrible at it. And there was stuff like trying to figure out like what music people listened to and what they talked about, what was on TV. I had to figure out what the plot of Star Wars was, because I got here after it had already come off the screens, and this is in the era before VCRs were commonplace, so I could I had to puzzle it back out from materials available. What the heck this like Han Solo guy is about?
What did you think it was about?
I don't know. I remember reading some reports in the Russian press about it. They wouldn't directly address the plot line. They just said it was a horrid capitalist fantasy.
I'll have to rewatch Star Wars and try to figure that one out. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So I know about you just from our previous interview that you are into punk music and the punk scene and have a history with that. And I wonder if being punk is in America is in any way like being part of the cynical generation in Russia.
No, I definitely think it's a continuum. I mean, originally, when I first found the punk scene towards the end of my high school years, it was mainly because I just did not want to be defined as just the Russian kid, you know? And in the punk scene at the time, everybody was weird. Everybody didn't fit in. Everybody was a misfit. Like, the fact that I was Russian was just a sideline to the fact that I had a crazy haircut, wore a leather jacket, and danced to fast music. So the punk scene became kind of my home. And the fact that it was that attitude, pervasive distrust of the government, pervasive denial of the popular culture of the time, it was all about, hey, you, the individual, this is about you.
Before we stop, this is sort of like random and a little off topic of the punk scene, but you have a story about the history of your accent.
Yeah, as you may have noticed, I still have an accent despite the fact of having lived here for 38 years. The deal is, I went to an English intensive school in Moscow, where starting in second grade, they taught us English. The problem is, we were taught by teachers who had never even visited the UK or America, and insisted that they knew the right way to pronounce things. So starting in second grade, I'd spend 3 hours a day doing pronunciation drills, trying to pronounce things exactly like my teachers wanted me to. And I guess it did its job. I still pronounce them that way to this day.
Well, it's a charming accent they have given you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Ilya.
Thank you, Gina.
When we come back, getting here from Mexico means you have to cross a border. We all know that. But how does a kid make sense of what it means to step over that invisible political line? That's next. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. On today's show, we're listening to a recording of a Central Standard live event back in October. It was an evening of immigration stories called How We Got Here. The next storyteller is Lisandra Garcia, who I originally met on this show.
So Lisandra Garcia is a DACA student, also known as a dreamer. She's a pre-law student at the Kansas City, Kansas Community College, and she works at a law firm, an immigration law firm, translating documents. She came to the United States when she was 7 years old, and we all know that dreamers crossed the border illegally as children, but what a lot of us don't think about is, I mean, at least I hadn't thought about this until meeting Lisandra, is what that risky adventure feels like to a kid. And according to Lisandra, it's kind of boring. More on that now. Hi, Lisandra.
Hi, Gina.
What was everyone. Boring to you about the journey from Mexico to the United States?
Well, as a kid, I didn't really know where I was going. I just was told one night, we're going to be reunited with your father, and we're going to go to El Norte, which translates to the north. And on my journey to here, I remember feeling this intensive heat that I had never felt before, and it was just the normal weather and at the border, I guess. And there was, the water tasted funny, and there was barely any grass, and I remember that we had to do a lot of walking, and the whole time I was told to be quiet, that I had to stay quiet at all times, and I remember that I had to be so quiet that I got bored eventually, and I started picking up rocks on the way because I had never seen such colorful rocks, and at this point we were in the desert, and I guess the rocks just took my attention. Later on at an airport, I was told to throw them all away because I couldn't, board the plane with a bunch of rocks in my pocket.
But I just love, that to a little kid, it's like what's happening here is that rocks are different.
Yes, and I remember at one point my mom was in to her waist in muddy water, and we were hiding behind bushes, and we were hiding in rivers, and we were crossing a parcela, which is just a field with strawberries or a field with lettuce. I don't recall what exactly it was, but the whole time I didn't know what was going on. I just was told to be quiet.
And so you were, and bored. But how much did you understand as a seven-year-old about why you were doing all that walking and being so quiet?
I didn't understand. The night before we left, my mom gathered a bunch of people at her house, which was kind of weird because we never had gatherings like that at my house. And she made this big pot of pozole, and all the people from church came over, and they were all crying and saying bye, and I was just saying, well, bye, see you. And, she just told me we're going to be reunited with my dad, who would just come and go at times. I don't recall seeing him that much in my house, but they said, we're going to be reunited with your dad, and that's all I knew.
And he was here on a work visa?
Yes, he was. He had been on a work visa for several years, just coming and going from the United States.
Your memories of the journey itself aren't in chronological order, is that right?
Yeah, actually, if I remember when you, told me to go to your office, you said, what would you say when, if somebody asks you, what do you recall, or how, what's the story like when you came to the United States? You know, and I told you one way, but if somebody like from the audience was asking the same question, I would probably start at another place, or I would start the story at a different, event, because I just don't remember in chronological order. I just remember parts and pieces and like the people I was traveling with.
And what I think is also super interesting about that is that you also, for most of these memories, don't know which side of the border you were on.
Yeah, I remember being at an airport. I remember crossing two rivers. I remember, the grass changing and the water tasting funny and being in the back of a semi. But I don't ever remember anybody specifically saying, well, now you're on the other side, or now you're in the United States, or we're still in Mexico. All I remember was, the weather changing and just people saying, we're going to El Norte.
Did you have people to guide you? I mean, how did you make that journey?
My mother and I, we were introduced to two young men. I remember them being really skinny. And they would just carry 2 gallons of water with them. And at a point, we were in the car with them, and they were just driving and driving and driving around the desert. And I was really confused. I said, why don't they stop driving? And the only time they would stop was at a little store in the middle of nowhere, and they would buy scratch tickets. And later asked my mom, why are they buying so many scratch tickets? What's that for? I didn't know it was to win money, but I also didn't know that they were trying to, play off that they were helping us, or that we were trying to cross the border.
Stall or something?
Yes, yes.
There seem, in the longer journey, like there are all these little stories along the way that don't fit in order, but there seem to be a lot of guys in trucks who drop you off somewhere and then give you instructions, like to cross a river or a creek or something, and then they tell you what to look out for next and who's going to come and get you, or how you'll know that you're with a safe person or a not safe person, or what to do to be taken a little further for the next leg of the journey.
Yes, those men, I think they were receiving orders from somebody else because they were always on the phone. But they would basically tell us, wait for a signal. I'm going to take my shirt off and act like I'm swimming in this river with everybody else. And then you guys will know to come out of the bushes and cross. Wait for my signal. Wait for the truck that's going to come and take you. And that's the signal that you get in the truck. Or wait for my signal to get out of this semi. We were in the back of a semi at one point, and it was just a bunch of boxes of sodas and soft drinks. And I had this thought of, how are we going to know when to get off? And so they told us, when we open the back of the semi and you hear our voice saying that it's us, and they said a specific word, they said, that's when you know you'll get off. But of course, I wasn't like aware, or I don't remember this secret word for it, because my job was just to stay quiet.
You know, I can't, you've said that this was boring, but just my own memories of what it's like to be a kid, it seems like being put in the back of a truck and told that there's a special word that will let you know that you're safe, that would be scary, that would just be terrifying.
Yeah, I think that I was, since I was surrounded, with my mom, and I was with a younger man, he was probably in his 20s, as a kid, he looked really old to me, but he was probably in his 20s, and there was a older woman, she was a senior woman, and she had her grandchild with her, and I just, the whole time through, and then seeing these two men that were always with us, I just thought that they would take care of us. And so there wasn't so much burden in us except for, you know, to stay quiet. And that's what I try to do, I guess, to avoid any conflict. I guess in the back of my head, I always thought that the adults were going to yell at me if I were, you know, was making noises or not following their instructions.
Wasn't there a point where you were waiting for one, you were dropped off somewhere and told to wait for this next truck that would come up? And it seems like you'd have to look for the white truck or look for the gray truck or something like that. But that one of these trucks took you to a house.
Yes, when we crossed that parcela with the lettuce or the strawberries, we were told to hide inside a river. And the river was, there was no water. And so that's why it was safe to hide there, which we didn't know until we got inside the river. But then they said, you're going to wait for this truck. If you see a gray truck, that's La Migra, that's immigration, that's ICE, so don't get out. But if you see this other colored truck, that's when you get out and you get inside. And so my mom was the one watching the whole time out for this, you know, truck. And when we got inside, I don't remember who was driving, but I remember getting to this house and there was so many other people there, and it had this fence around it, and it was an ugly house. And it smelled really bad. There was a lot of animals and dogs, and I just remember the smell and the people and them offering me Gatorade, and when I picked the red one.
When you said before that you knew that part of the reason you weren't scared is because that was kind of the adult's job. You knew that the adults were worrying about things for you. It seems like maybe that kind of changed when you got to the U.S. and you went to school in Kansas City and didn't speak the language, and that was something that your parents couldn't help you with.
Yes, assimilating was very, very hard. You know, you have the funny taste of water. You have the funny...
What is it about the water?
My mom, we got to a hotel at one point that we were crossing, and my mom suffers, like... from her kidneys, and so she has to drink a lot of water so she doesn't get sick. And so they forgot to give us water. They bought us a bunch of soda, but they forgot to give us water. And so my mom started to get sick because of all this walking, and she said, well, I'm gonna drink out of the faucet, you know? And so she grabs water from the faucet, and she says, it's so nasty, it tastes like Clorox. And so she's like, try it. And so I say, it tastes like water can't taste like Clorox. And so I try it, and it tasted like Clorox. And so assimilating was really hard.
Does tap water here still taste like Clorox to you?
It does, and surprisingly. Only the good water, I guess, tap water that I've tried is like in Olathe. They have the best tap water. So
I'll have to try that.
Yeah, try Olathe, you know, tap water. assimilating is really hard. You know, you have the funny tasting water, you have the funny tasting tortillas. You know, in Mexico, I had my grandma make tortillas from scratch every morning, and, you know, and then you get here and it comes out of a pack that you buy at Some Fresh, and it has lime in it, and it just tastes like really sweet corn. And now I'm used to it, you know, living 12 years here, but at first I would cry over the taste of tortillas. And then also going to school, starting at school was so hard for me. Over in Mexico, you know, and I'm going to criticize the school system here in the United States, but they don't give you diplomas for just anything. Like, you really have to work hard and earn it. You know, here you get certificates for, like, you were late every day. Like, here's a certificate. you know, like, thanks, I really tried. But, you know, you would really, really have to work hard in Mexico to get a diploma. And so my last year in Mexico, I got a diploma. And so I was like one of the smart, you know, students. And I get here and I don't understand a word. I don't understand, you know, the worksheets. I don't understand what's on the board. I don't even understand what my teacher's saying. I don't know what's a single word that's coming from her mouth. And so I was assigned a personal translator at school. I went to Emmy Pearson in Kansas City. And you know, you when I would get home from school, my first years, I thought that my parents could help me with homework. You know, I said, I don't understand it, but that I can go home and my parents are going to help me. You know, that's the normal thing. And then come to it, well, they don't understand either. And so I would cry and cry every night because I wanted to go back home. And also because, you know, I was an overachiever in Mexico and school, and here I'm just behind in everything. I remember being assigned to a test. It was the KELPA test. Now if you don't pass it by the time you're in 12th grade, you have to take classes in school that say you're in a lower level, like not even your prerequisites. Like before you take your prerequisites, if you don't pass that test, you still have to pay for these classes, you know. But that test, basically all it was saying, like it had a picture of a cat and a dog and a slide, and they would point to it and they'd say, tell me what this is. And I didn't know. And so it was really hard for me.
How did that change? Do you remember it changing, the struggle with the language?
I don't know how it happened, but I remember being put in a like advanced class for reading in my third or fourth year in school, like third or fourth grade. And at some point I remember thinking to myself, when did I learn English? Like, I don't remember when I learned it, but here I am. And yeah.
You know, I know you don't know which side of the border you were on for a lot of the journey. And that's a big part of what I love about your story, is just that there's this thing that has all this political weight and a lot of, so it's a border that's this abstract political border, and it's also a physical thing that there's a concrete danger in crossing it, and that you didn't see it. You were just being a person on the planet who was walking and looking at rocks that are cool and grass that is different and water that is different. To me, that's really kind of beautiful.
Yes, you know, people, when they cross the border, you know, for my parents, it was for my mother, it was a sacrifice, you know, not having water and her kidneys almost failing. And, you know, people sometimes die when they're on this journey. And for me, it was, you know, just something different. But, you know, I did an interview with a 41 Action News and about DACA. And I think that's a really important part about DACA, that they're trying to, you know, legalize people that came here as children. And, you know, the argument is it wasn't really their fault. Like, they weren't trying to break the law. They were just coming here for a better life. And, you know, there was a lot of people that criticized, you know, no, it doesn't matter that Lisandra came as a child. She needs to go back. She needs to be sent back home, and you need to go back to her country. But I think the weight of, you know, me as a child and many other children that crossed the border, you know, when they were 2 years old, when they were 10 years old, and by the time they're like 16, they ask for their social security so they can get a driver's license, but all of a sudden, you know, they come to the realization that they don't have a social security, and they just never knew that. I think for children, there is no border. You know, children don't know what borders are.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. And now we're going to talk to one of my producers, Sylvia Maria Gross. And Sylvia has a prop, as you can see. Sylvia is the senior producer of Central Standard, and she has her own story to tell. She's going to talk to us, excuse me, about the predicament of the next generation, starting with a request.
Alexa, play Seo Georgi on Spotify.
I can't find Seo Gigi on Spotify.
Alexa, play Seo Georgi on Spotify.
I can't find Seo Georgi on Spotify.
Alexa, play Seo Jorge on Spotify.
Playing songs by Jorge Lopez Escribano from Spotify.
Alexa, stop.
Sylvia, you speak Portuguese. Your mom comes from Brazil. You grew up bilingual, but Alexa does not seem to speak Portuguese.
Alexa, what language do you speak?
I speak fluent English and a bit of Klingon.
English and Klingon.
I've checked the language packs. I think that she speaks German now, if you set her up the right way, but
not Portuguese.
Not Portuguese.
So you posted on Facebook about this predicament, that you were trying to figure out how much you could butcher the pronunciation of this musician's name while maintaining self-respect.
So I know that I actually have managed to do it, so Alexa does understand. I can't remember. I can try one more time. Alexa, play Seo Jorge on Spotify. I don't know. It's just a weird thing, because I have always grown up with the understanding, or just with two different frames of reference, and so it took me a while to sort of understand that a way of pronouncing something was not the way that my American English-speaking friends pronounce something, if that makes any sense. So then trying to translate into what this English-speaking machine would understand those letters to read is a weird mental exercise that also feels kind of ugly.
Yeah. Language has been a part of your story from the beginning.
It has. My mom moved to the United States, I think in 1968 it was, but she met my dad, who was an American in Brazil. She had. She was the first woman from her town to go to college. She grew up in a really small rural town in Brazil, and she was really academically oriented. Her uncle was actually mayor of the town, but he was kind of one of these self-taught people in this very small rural community. Her brother was the first to go to college in the town. She was the next. He became the town's first doctor. She went to school for languages. And my aunt told me, my mom's sister, that my mom was just that they always knew my mom was going to leave and go someplace else. And they thought she was going to go to France, because the language she was studying was French. She went to college for French and Portuguese, but she also studied English. So when my dad, who was an anthropologist from the United States, was living in the town next to hers and met her, my mom's uncle, the mayor, my mom's uncle was like, we have somebody in our town that speaks French and English. So this is somebody who can help you. And so he introduced my dad to my mom, and they were married, and they moved to the United States.
Just knowing you as a friend, you grew up speaking two languages, but even though you were born here and you are 100% American and have been your whole life, I also really get the feeling that you have two homes.
Well, I've always actually kind of wondered about, because as a child, I always described myself as half Brazilian, half American. That was just, I guess, what my parents told me that I was. So, and then as I became a high school student and an adult, I just thought, well, half is weird, because I am all American, but I am also a lot Brazilian, and I'm actually citizens of both countries, so I am technically Brazilian, all Brazilian and all American, but trying to figure out the percentages is something I spent some time actually kind of thinking about. Like, maybe I'm 100% American, but also 60% Brazilian or something like that. But as a kid,
Sylvia used to be a math teacher.
I'm into math, so I really wanted to know the exact percentages. But as a kid, I spent a couple of years between when I was 2 to when I was 4 in Brazil. And I learned to speak Portuguese before I learned to speak English, so I always had a strong connection to Portuguese and had part of me that thinks in Portuguese, but it also is very much that English. I went to school in English. Most of my friends were in English, so, like, that is my native language, but in a way my maternal language is still Portuguese.
You told me a really sweet story one day about a game you and your brother used to play involving a blanket?
Well, we would be on my parents' bed, and we went then every other year we spent our summers in Brazil. So we would be on my parents' bed, and we would go say, okay, we're in the U.S. now, and we'd speak English, and then we'd go under the blanket and go out to the other side of the bed, and then we'd speak to each other in Portuguese and say we were in Brazil. So it was sort of that. I think that, like a lot of people, like I grew up with this idea that there was this place and that place, and those two places were my places, and they weren't necessarily that they were like different countries with borders. They were just this place and that place.
Just one side of the blanket and the other.
Yeah, but like those two parts of who you are, you know?
Now that you're a grown-up, like what do those two languages and two homes mean to you in your everyday life?
Well, I find since I've been in Kansas City, and I have some Brazilian friends and I have some connection to the Brazilian community, but I am less connected than ever before. So I find myself speaking Portuguese less and less often. I talk to my mom most days, and I usually talk to her in Portuguese, but it's a weird thing of disconnecting from the language. And then when I am in a Brazilian setting, like either I go to Brazil and visit family or I'm in a Brazilian setting here in Kansas City, it's like re-encountering like the most common things. And I was joking with a Brazilian friend of mine about, he forgot the word for hanger. Like, how do you say hanger in Portuguese? And it was like, oh, cabide. That's like, wow, I'm re-encountering with a hanger in Portuguese. And all of these things, but or context, like the songs you heard on a Brazilian TV show for children as a kid, you're like, oh yeah. And it's just like settling back into this thing that you don't encounter all the time, but you miss and feels like part of you, but you, I don't know, the words themselves, the language feels like they take you there.
And there's a word for this kind of in Portuguese.
So there's a word in Portuguese that's kind of known as one of those untranslatable words, saudade. I don't know if people have heard that before, but it's a word for, it's kind of like nostalgia, missing, a longing. And I think about that a lot because saudade is missing something, but it also reminds me of the gap that, like, in translation, there's always a gap between the exact meaning and context and flavor of a word in one language, and you can never translate that to the other language. And that gap, in some ways, like, I feel that very strongly because it's so sad, that saudade, that missing of this place. And as the next generation, I mean, it was really my mom who moved here. I'm the next generation who has that strong familiarity, but always that gap. I'm never going to be fully know that culture and be in that culture. Like I always say, like when I'm in Brazil, I'll talk to somebody for about 15 minutes until they're like, wait, you're not totally Brazilian, are you? That's like my time to be totally Brazilian. And after about 15 minutes, I make a mistake or something that like clearly is just a little weird.
Aww. Well, you have two young daughters, and I mean, do you think that there will be a predicament of that generation?
Well, I have just some sadness about it and some sort of, I don't know what word to choose, like realism about it, but I think it's very hard. And I know I have a lot of friends who are raising their kids to be bilingual. They tend to have been the immigrant themselves rather than children of, because it's easier when it's just so natural. That's the natural language to speak to your child. I really do try to expose my kids to being Brazilian and their Brazilian part of their identity, but it's too hard for me to speak to them in Portuguese all the time or even most of the time as they get older and talk and respond. And it makes me sad. It's that gap. It's that missing, that saudade, because I want them. I wish I could give them that, that I grew up with, the bilingualness that I grew up with that my parents were able to give to me. But it's been hard to pass that on, and it's hard to lose that as much as I want to expose them to that identity and songs and music and going there occasionally.
Into the frustration of knowing what it is to have to mispronounce words in Portuguese so that you can play music like an American on Spotify?
Exactly. I mean, it just to have to wrench your mind into a different mindset. But I don't know that they'll know that because they're very entrenched in the mindset and the language that they're learning here.
Sylvia, thank you so much. This is Sylvia Maria Gross.
To listen back to this encore presentation or any favorite shows you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there and stay current on our news by following us on Twitter. We are at @KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to KCUR. No cartório, na igreja.